Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's January 18th program, Keeping Martin Luther King Jr.'s Dream Alive, Decoding Language. This is the 17th program of our 2018-2019 program year. I'm Joel Curran, President of City Club. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. We have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high quality, affordable health care services and to improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. Okay. The University of Oregon. Since 1876, the UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, and that's the first time I've said that correct in 2 months, and act creatively. Can't get it all right. Our Sapphire sponsor, Johnson, Johnson, Lucas, and Middleton. Support for City Club comes from the law offices of Johnson, Johnson, Lucas, and Middleton, whose mission is to obtain justice and fair compensation for people who have harmed because of someone's wrongful conduct. More information at justicelawyers.com. Words matter. Words can hurt. Frank Luntz, who is a pollster and a conservative wordsmith, advises companies on advertising and political candidates on messaging. He is the one who changed drilling for oil to energy exploration. He is the one who changed estate or inheritance taxes to death taxes. He is the one who changed global warming to climate change, a much softer and gentler word for the heating up of our planet. He wrote a book, and the title of the book is Words That Work. It's not what you say, it's what they hear. Every couple who's had an argument has basically about, it's not what you say, it's what they heard. And this, what is said and what is heard, is also important in our public discourse and in our discourse between and among the races. Today, our program will deal with attempting to decode languages or decode language. What was said? What was heard? The speakers today are familiar with the process and will give us the benefit of their wisdom. Greg Evans is a Eugene City Councilor, an educator, community activist. He's also a classroom instructor, lecturer, workshop facilitator, and consultant. Mr. Evans holds a Bachelor of Science degree in marketing from Myers University in Cleveland, and a master's degree in education from Oregon State University. He is a recipient of numerous awards for his work, including 5 Martin Luther King Jr. Awards, the NAACP Thalmayer Award, the NAACP Eugene Springfield Branch Community Leadership Award, and the Oregon Assembly for Black Affairs Education Award. Joseph Lowndes is an associate professor of political science at the University of Oregon, where he teaches courses on U.S. politics, racial politics, political culture, and American political thought. He's an expert on conservatism, the Tea Party, the social movements, the GOP, race and elections, and the author of From New Deal to New Right, Race and the Southern Origins of Modern Conservatism. He is the co-editor of race in American political development, and he's just recovering from having taught Silver about 10 years ago. He should be better any day now. Lou Whitebear is an enrolled member of the Coastal Band of Chumash Nation and is assistant director of the OSU Native American Longhouse, Ina Howes. She is a PhD student in Women, Gender, and Sexuality program at OSU, with research focusing on indigenous rhetoric, reclaiming of indigenous identity and gender roles, missing and murdered indigenous women, indigenous resistance to movements, and natural resource protection. Dr. Yvette Alex Ascenso joined the U of O faculty as Vice President for Equity and Inclusion, with responsibility for collaboratively leading the University of Oregon's efforts to embed inclusion, equity, and diversity in its institutional practices. She is the daughter of Louisiana, so if you know where to get good gumbo or crawfish etouffee, come up and talk to her after the program. Today's program was coordinated by Kyle Shavir and Jessica Guerrieri. And now, today's program is going to deviate a little bit from the format, and the speakers are going to sit at a table and address you from there. So if you would now go up to the table, we'd appreciate it.
Good afternoon. I'm not sure if I should be the lead-off speaker on this or not. Again, just to give you a quick introduction, my name is Greg Evans. I am a Eugene City Councilor, 34-year resident of the City of Eugene, and I'm also Associate Vice President for Equity and Inclusion at Lane Community College. Been involved in a number of efforts around this community for the past 30 some odd years. But I want to kind of talk to you a little bit about, you know, our topic this afternoon in terms of keeping the dream alive, of decoding language. Language is important. I want to talk to you about the perspective of language and its impact that it has on our children, and most prominently our children of color. I have raised five children, four boys, and I have one girl left. You know, my wife snuck up on me one day and said, "Guess what, we're pregnant." I said, "How did that happen?" She said, "You ought to know you were there." But it kind of, when you start cycling back around and it's you know, your youngest is 13 years old and then you have a baby girl comes along, it's a whole nother, another experience and a very rewarding experience. I'm gonna talk to you perspective of our children of color, our African-American children, because my children in this community have faced racism and discrimination and things that I thought we should be past, we are not past. Let me give you an example. Back in the mid-1990s, when my boys were going to school in 4J, my youngest son came, we were in the car, I picked him up, they were going to Eastside then, which at the time was located in Willard School. I picked him up from school one morning, or one afternoon, and we were driving around the corner, and I was coming down 29th and getting ready to turn onto Willamette Street, and my youngest was in the back, and he said, "Dad, I don't want to be black anymore." Now, he was 6 years old, and my other son was sitting in the front to the right of me, and he shook his head and he said, "What did you say that to Dad for?" You know, he was just like, because he had been through this before. And so to keep from crashing my car, I pulled over off on 27th Street. And when I did, I stopped the car, I looked around, I looked in the back, and I asked Keenan, I said, why did you say that? He said, because nobody likes black people. That was the message that he got in first grade. In a progressive, affluent school, one of the best in this community. So many of you have not had to have the experience to talk to your children about their own self-worth and their own self-esteem. I have had to do that numerous times, not only with my own children, but with other people's children. And not having those tools in my hand, and when not being able to see the pain that my children and other children suffered because they were told that they were not good enough. They've been told that they're not smart enough, not just by their classmates, but often by other students and teachers and people who are designed to help you out and help you become successful in the school system. I fast forward that to a few years ago when one of my sons, who wasn't driving at the time, who was biking it throughout this community, he had a job, he had two jobs, he bought himself a $5,000 bike. And I told him, I said, why did you buy that bike? I said, you're putting a target on your back. And he said, well, Dad, it's my money, and that's the bike I want. I said, well, then you should have it. But he was stopped no less than 13 times by police who wanted to know in different contexts, how did you get that bicycle? Where are you going? Where are you coming from? He was stopped outside of his job at Market of Choice before he even got on his bike by a police officer who wanted to know, you know, where did you get the bike from? Can you produce a bill of sale? And those are just some of the things. So I fast forward to another story, and that is with my daughter. Now, the difference between my daughter and my youngest son is 13 years. She's 13 years old now. She is in middle school. But I'll never forget the day that I picked her up from school and she asked me, Daddy, what is an N-word? So I give you those examples. Oh, she heard it. Trust me, that's why she asked me. She heard it in her classroom. That word was directed towards her. So you see, words are weapons. They're weapons against each and every one of us. And they're words are weapons against our children. And what we say and what we convey and what we mean is important beyond just somebody flapping their gums. I told you I have five children. My four boys are grown. None of them live here. And that's not necessarily because of design. Some of it is because of the career paths that they have taken and they have chosen. But this, and they have told me this, Dad, this is not the most comfortable place to live if you are black or biracial. And that is true. I have run programs for African American youth, Native American, Latino, Pan-Asian American, and there's one theme that ripples through there, is the illusion of Eugene as being a progressive community that welcomes and supports all people, regardless of the color of their skin, their religion, their sexual orientation. It's not true. And, you know, the reason why I got involved in politics here was a week after I came here. I came here on a visit. I was going to go, my intention was to go to the Bay Area to kind of reinvent my life, but instead of taking the left turn, I took the right turn, right? And I ended up here, and I was walking down the street on 13th Street towards the University of Oregon when a police car pulled up and cut me off. And I was asked a number of questions about who I was, where I was, why I come here. I gave him my Ohio driver's license at the time. Come to find out later, about 3 or 4 days later, I read an article in the Register Guard in which I understood that they were, at that time, doing a dragnet looking for an African-American suspect from Seattle who had murdered his grandmother. And the description of this person, I'll just tell you, was 6'3" and 140 pounds and light skin. So there is no way. The last time I was 143 pounds, I think I was in the 10th grade, okay? But I understood after that numerous African Americans, men and women, that night were stopped by the police. We have issues in this community. We have not gotten past a number of things that we should be past by now. And if you look at what's going on in our school systems, the fact that less than 50% of African American boys graduate on time in this community, the fact that we don't have the jobs and the job security that many of you may have in this room, the fact that we have not just an education system, but a community that does not embrace all is very disturbing. And I'll wrap up with this. This past year was my 40th high school reunion back in Cleveland. And I was honored to be selected as the dinner speaker for that event. And when I went back, and I know that I haven't lived there in 30 some odd years, it is a completely different place than what it was when I grew up. It's a lot more dangerous place, and a place where our public school systems have really bottomed out. But I spent 5 days there, and the thing that struck me was this, and I've lived here 33 years. I own a house, owned my house for 19 years in the Bethel area. But when I got back on that plane and I came back home and I switched planes in Denver, I started crying. And I didn't know where that came from. And what I realized on the flight back from Denver to Eugene is this. As I knew that Cleveland is no longer my home, and that where I was coming to didn't feel like home. It's the place I live, but it doesn't feel like home. And in that moment, I really felt a deep sadness, because I would like to call this place my home. Thank you.
Okay, thanks everyone for being here today, and thanks the City Club and Jesse for organizing this, and to Silver, who is indeed my former student, who I made him do plenty of presentations back in the day, so he's kind of getting me back here, I think, although, as I tell him, it better be good. Okay, so in the last 3 years, we've seen the emergence of an emboldened movement of violent white supremacy across the country and across Oregon. It arose from internet chat rooms and from tiny groups of Nazis and Klan members. It emerged from Obama-hating birther conspiracy theorists, from diehard xenophobes, Islamophobes, and dedicated anti-Semites. It blossomed in Donald Trump's presidential campaign in 2016, which became a space where previously hidden racist fantasies could be said out loud and then could be fashioned into campaign planks calling for Muslim bans, a mass roundup of 11 million undocumented people, and much more. In the last 2 years, we've seen a White House more openly committed to the tenets of white supremacy than any in the past century. Steve Bannon, Stephen Miller, Jeff Sessions, Chris Kobach, and others who have had clear ties to racist figures and organizations and have made racially oriented policies a fundamental imperative of the Trump administration. Along with it came a dramatic upsurge of white racist violence, from everyday harassment of people of color to the organized brutality of groups like Identity Europa, American Vanguard, and the Proud Boys, to individual acts of murder ranging from Heather Heyer's fate at the hands of James Fields in Charlottesville, to Jeremy Christian's MAX train killings up in Portland, to the pogrom at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh last fall. Historians and political scientists debate the proper definition of fascism, but what we are seeing very definitely is the rise of an authoritarian politics based on beliefs and racial hierarchy, both genetic and cultural, that rivals the 1930s in many respects. Oregon reported 145 hate crimes last year, up 40% from the year before, half of them reported in Eugene. And due to the very thorough efforts of anti-fascist activists, a number of people nestled within our own liberal community have been discovered to be organized white supremacists here. But I think a mistake that a lot of us make is to see this moment as having come out of nowhere, hitting the earth like an angry orange meteor. Do with that metaphor what you will. If that were the case, it would make the problem much easier to deal with, I think. But the truth is, white supremacy is deeply rooted in American society. As a nation founded on native genocide, land theft, black slavery, and empire building, how could it be otherwise? Race and racial hierarchy were assumed by the founders and transmitted structurally, institutionally, and culturally across the American landscape in the centuries that followed. There is no part of American history that hasn't been shaped in some ways by race and racism. Since this program is partly about language, our own shared language, words like freedom, independence, and liberty have been saturated in racial meanings over time and still are today. Slavery has had a long afterlife in the form of Jim Crow, exclusion from the social and economic provisions of the New Deal, continued economic theft, mass incarceration, police killing, and state abandonment. Settler colonialism is not an event in the past either, but an ongoing process of the dispossession of Native people. And anti-Latinx and anti-Asian racism, along with anti-Semitism, have long legacies that still shape the current moment. This is true of Oregon in distinct ways. We think proudly of the Oregon Trail and the courageous pioneers who traveled it and populated the region. The mythic independent Oregon pioneer was actually quite dependent on the U.S. military to help take the land and slaughter its inhabitants over and over again. Thus, from the start, Oregon was fashioned as a white racial homeland. When it became an official territory, Oregon barred both slaves and free blacks in its constitution. In many places, Chinese could not own land. Many of you have been to Pendleton and have seen the 70 miles of underground tunnels where Chinese were forced to live underground because you could not purchase land on the surface. And Japanese Americans, as we know, were forced from their communities and into internment camps with a station here in Eugene during World War II. The whiteness that we take as a given in this state is no accident. It's not just Oregon doesn't happen to be a white place. It is rather an historic and contemporary form of violence. This foundational violence, let's call it, presents enormous challenges to overcoming racial oppression in the United States, here in Oregon, and here in Lane County. If you're white, it's hard to see how racialized domination operates because we don't feel its everyday barbs, as Greg spoke of, nor its deeper institutional effects, which Greg also spoke of. We are granted a blissful unawareness of it. Understanding racism does not come easy to white folks. And actually, for white liberals, I think the challenge is more difficult still. Believing in principles of racial equality and fairness, it can be hard to imagine that you are complicit in any of it. It's easy to look at people who are openly racist or who support spending billions on a wall to seal off our southern border, who imagine that Sharia law is just around the corner, who think affirmative action is white genocide, or who simply voted for Trump in 2016. It is easy to look at them and say, there, that's the problem. It is much harder to dwell on the shared assumptions, benefits, and unquestioned sense of place afforded to those of us who are part of the political construction called the white race. There is connective tissue between the everyday reproduction of a racist society and the rise of the far-right white supremacy that we see today. So what do I mean by complicity? Well, we don't control the conditions into which we're born, but I think we ultimately have some say over how we respond to those conditions. So complicity means not confronting racism, subtle or not so subtle, in our social spaces, in our families, or in our workplaces. It means not joining struggles against racism, and it means not supporting others who do that work. Martin Luther King stated the point frankly in his book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community? He wrote, "The white liberal must see that the Negro needs not only love, but justice. It is not enough to say, we love Negroes. We have many Negro friends. They must demand justice for Negroes. Love that does not satisfy justice is no love at all. It is merely a sentimental affection, little more than what one would have as love for a pet. Love is at its best justice concretized. Love is unconditional. It is not conditional upon one staying in his place or watering down his demands in order to be considered respectable." But beyond the question of confronting race and racism in a simple sense, King ultimately called on us to do something more, I think. Late in his too short life, he began to more explicitly link what he called the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism. He understood that racism, capitalism, and empire were deeply connected and had to be confronted together. He spoke of militarism and American imperialism in the context of the Vietnam War. After his famous Riverside Church address opposing that war in 1967, he was attacked on the editorial pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post, and by other civil rights organizations that thought that questions of civil rights and war should be kept separate. He also turned toward the issue of poverty as one of the deepest challenges in American society. The Poor People's Campaign, launched by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, was, as he saw it, the next phase of the civil rights struggle, one that could create a multiracial coalition against poverty. As he said, call it democracy or call it democratic socialism, but there must be a better distribution of wealth within this country for all God's children. Remember that when he was assassinated at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis in 1968, he was there in support of a sanitation workers' strike. So why do I raise this? As I said before, the rise of the racist right is new and distinct, but it emerges out of a society already steeped in racism. Part of why we find ourselves in this moment, though, is that we live in a time of great economic uncertainty and social dislocation. Our schools, libraries, social services, elder care, emergency services, on and on, suffer and decline even as enormous fortunes continue to be made. Parts of our neighboring counties lack basic 911 service or law enforcement. The gap between the very richest Americans and everyone else is greater than at any time in U.S. history. White folks, weaned on a steady diet of racial myths our whole lives, will easily avail ourselves of racist explanations. And if you are in an economically precarious situation, that only intensifies. And indeed, we now see anti-Semitism, that socialism of fools, back again with a brutal ferocity, doing the same kind of explanatory work. The globalists, we're told, are to blame for job losses and economic woes. George Soros, the Jewish billionaire, is helping undocumented Latinos steal our elections and funding protests against the president. We know, of course, that white deprivation is relative, that black and brown households have done far worse than white households since the crash of 2008. But But we also know that our political crisis can't be understood or combated without thinking about how to confront these at once. We have a broken political system that subverts democracy as it continues to reward the rich, making our society ever more radically unequal in terms of class, race, and political power. And I'd like to remind my fellow white folks here that struggles waged by people of color against racism in this country have always expanded freedom and democracy and economic equality for everyone else. Fortunately, we have struggles to inspire us, to help us remember how to struggle, from the movement for black lives against police violence and mass imprisonment, to the fight against the Dakota Pipeline, which threatens everyone's health, resistance to ICE raids, to Antifa's confrontation of fascists online and in the streets. And we have our unions, community groups, and political organizations that will benefit from our energy. We can start there. And in fact, I think we have a women's march this weekend. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate being on this panel with my esteemed panelists. And I'd like to talk a bit about this morning, or this afternoon, it is now, language. Can you hear me?
Your name.
Okay, Yvette Alex Asenso. I didn't want to waste time doing that as we were already introduced before, but Yvette Alex Asenso, Professor of Political Science, Vice President for Equity and Inclusion at the University of Oregon. So I will start again to make sure that you heard me. I want to extend a big appreciation to Jessica and Kyle and Silva for the invitation, along with you members of the City Club as well. And I also appreciate having the honor and opportunity of serving on this panel with my esteemed panelists. Also want to send a shout out to my husband, Dr. A.B. Asenso, who's the real expert on Dr. King, having written two or three books and several articles on his work and legacy. As someone who comes from the University of Oregon, my comments will be focused primarily on what we are trying to do with respect to King and decoding language on the university campus, but also what we as a community should be thinking about. Words indeed have power. And when you think about the legacy of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that legacy does not come in the form of lots of political might. Indeed, he was unelected. He was a man whose words, in fact, inspired change in political decision makers, and they in turn, along with those who marched in the streets, the local kinds of movements that took place, really revolutionized not only our country, but our world. At the same time, I think that we often focus too much on the language of King, the mild language of King, without understanding that there was an urgency to that language. And I want to share with you a quote from his book, Why We Can't Wait, to get at this urgency that we have that's been recreated by the social context of conflict around language. He said, and I quote, "Perhaps it is easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say wait. But when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you see the vast majority of 20 million Negro brothers smothering an airtight cargo of poverty in the midst of affluent society, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughters why they can't go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television, and see the tears welling in her eyes when she is told that Funtown is closed to colored children, and see the ominous clouds of inferiority beginning to form in their little mental sky. When you take a cross-country drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in the uncomfortable corners of your automobile because no motel will accept you, and when your wife and mother are never given the title Mrs. When you forever see fighting a denigrating sense of nobodiness, and when you will understand why we find it difficult to wait, there comes a time when the cup of endurance runs over and when men are no longer willing to be plunged into the abyss of despair," end quote. When we think about what's going on a lot in our current conversation around language, there's this idea that what about the First Amendment? And why is it that people can't express their thoughts? It is a guarded priority and promise of the American society that we need to guard and safeguard. Martin Luther King, during his time, realized that speech is indeed important. And for the many people who suffer and who are on the receiving end of language that is racist and hostile, that is filled with hate, no one is saying that we should not prize free speech. But what people are saying and demanding is that humanity must also be respected, and that as fellow human beings, that is our first priority. When we think about Martin Luther King, he also understood the importance of the language of law. And we know that law is often seen as objective. The First Amendment is seen as something that is objective and above and beyond feelings and culture and nations and things of that sort. But what we know is that law itself was created and is influenced by culture. And what we see in this sort of confluence between the two, the tension between the two, is a prioritizing of culture, of whiteness in American society, without understanding as well the extent to which other values should also take place and should also have a role there. Another point that I'd like to make is that when we talk about hate speech, what we often find great discomfort in are the words like nigger or other racial and ethnic epithets. What we also don't realize is that there are other words that perhaps don't necessarily cause us as much discomfort, but are perhaps more harmful, especially in terms of their economic impact and their impact in terms of being able to be included in society than those words, or just as important as those words. And I'll give you one word that's often used in the employment context, for example, that excludes so many people of color from opportunities. It's the word fit. Does that person really fit with our department? Do they fit in our graduate programs? Will they fit in our neighborhoods, in our clubs, in our society, in our societies, in our organizations? The word fit is perhaps one of the most damaging and exclusive terms that is used on our campus and in our communities, because it is the word that brings in subjectivity, that overrides all of the other objective factors that are important in making decisions. And so while we are focusing on hate and racism, which are very important, I would also remind all of us in here who have access to power and authority that that word fit is also something that should be used and thought about and reflected on. When we think about reflection, another aspect of Dr. King's legacy was that his words inspired reflection. They weren't only on this notion of the racist out there, but they called all of us to internalize and think about how it is that we treated one another. He talked a lot about this notion of love, and in fact, he often said that hate does not drive out hate. Only love can do that. And so part of the work that we're doing, not only on our campus, but we're doing in the communities and organizations that I belong to, is a focus on four different values: love, authenticity, courage, and empathy. Love is this idea of self-sacrifice, of actually engaging in a way that puts others at par with oneself. So love is kind. Love is forgiving. Love doesn't give up. Love never fails. Then this notion of authenticity. Thinking about our organizations and the extent to which we allow newcomers to bring their authentic selves into community, or do we suggest that they somehow have to fit into our conception of what it means to be an Oregonian or Eugenian, or to belong to a certain campus or a certain community? The third concept that I think we find with King is courage. This idea that we have to stretch ourselves beyond fear and anxiety to really move forward as individuals, as campuses, as communities. And what that means is not just saying I'm afraid and I'm not going to do it, but really having the will to say I'm going to do it even though I'm afraid, doing it while I'm afraid and moving forward. And that is so very important, especially for people who are privileged. Everyone in this room is privileged in some way. We need to think about, and that's what King talked about, using our privilege in a way that helps others. And being allies means making sure that we're being allies in ways that benefit the folks that we're trying to help, not imputing upon them our will or our sense of what fairness and justice look like, but working with them toward their goals and keeping those goals in mind and standing down, frankly, when those goals conflict. And then finally, this notion of empathy. And if King was a master of anything, he was a master of helping people to understand the value of empathy, walking in someone else's place, carrying their load, their burden, their viewpoint of the world in their eyes. And as we think about what it means to really keep Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's dream alive, we need to understand that all of those values are not only concepts and values that he used, but if we're going to see forward movement in our country, we have to make sure that it's a part of our daily walk as well. Thank you so much.
Haku, my name is Lihui Whitebear, and I'm a member of the Coastal Band of the Chumash Nation. I wanted to start off by giving thanks and recognizing that we are on Kalapuya land. The Kalapuya people of this area were forcibly removed through a series of treaties in 1855 and in 1856 as well, I believe, in this area, and are now members of the Confederated Tribes of Tsleil-Waututh Indians and Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde Community of Oregon. So I always like to start by situating myself in whose ancestral homelands we are in. It's really important to me as an Indigenous person. I consider myself a visitor here, even though I've lived in Oregon for well over half my life. These are not my ancestral homelands, and I like to acknowledge that and give respect to the people whose land we're on. One of the things that I was thinking about as I prepared for today was, of course, about language, but also about the way that we use words, and I really appreciate everybody's bringing up how words impact each other, our families, our children, and the community. One of the words that I wanted us to think about today was the word power and how we use that. A lot of times when we describe the word power, we think of like who's in power as in a structural sense, right? Like who has political power, who has the top positions. And when I think about power and the way that we situate ourselves with that, it's also a way that we start describing ourselves as powerless. And I think that's a dangerous situation to put ourselves in, as far as being able to create change if we say we don't have the power to do that. And so being able to recognize and understand the power that we each hold within ourselves and how we can collectively draw from each other to create a different type of power than the structural one that causes a lot of oppression in the society that we live in. As an Indigenous person, I face a lot of ugliness in this world. We live with settler colonialism. I'm not going to speak for every single Indigenous person. I want to throw that out there as well. But my experiences have been not the greatest growing up. I'm originally from Southern California, but I also spent quite a bit of time on the Oregon coast and in the Willamette Valley. And it's been a real struggle because of the way that people use language to describe Indigenous people, not only to describe us, but also to erase us. And that's part of the struggle of living with the ongoing settler colonial presence. And part of that complexity is like, we appreciate everybody that is here. It's not like saying it's everybody's fault for continuing to be on occupied land, but it's a way to recognize that we live with a lot of pains that have been passed down generationally because of what has happened for everybody to be here now. A lot of the work that I do in the communities has to do with social justice work, basically. And right now, some of the things that are coming up have to do with things that were brought up earlier with the borders, a lot of anti-immigration rhetoric that's going on in this country. And a lot of well-intended people that mean really good will come up with things like we're a nation of immigrants and things like using the song This Land Is Our Land to describe a sense of belonging for everybody and don't realize the larger implications that has on Indigenous people. When folk hear that, it erases the fact that we've been here since time immemorial. We've been here since way before this land was called the United States or it was termed North America. And so to describe it as a nation of immigrants erases our presence, it erases our past, and it erases everything about us. And this land is our land is super problematic for Native folk as well. And I understand it creates a sense of unity for other folk, but it also reinforces that idea that the land was taken. And if you haven't learned about that that part of the United States history or North American history, I encourage you to learn more about how that happened. I know the K-12 system is deeply flawed in being able to describe the experiences of Indigenous people. I have kids in the K-12 programs in Oregon, and that's been ongoing since everybody was younger as well. A lot of times I think of how different things would be in people's understandings of being in relationship with each other if they would teach about things like sovereignty and treaties. That's part of the foundations of this country, but it's something that nobody ever learns about. And it's not until folk are in college a lot of times that they are able to hear about those things and the larger impacts it has. And the other part with that is that it impacts everybody, that lack of knowledge and that erasure of Indigenous people. One of the things that happens sometimes for myself is people look at me and they're like, I don't know what you are. What are you? A lot of folk may have that experience being, maybe not in this room, being asked like, not like, where are you from or anything like that, but like, what are you? Like, or that makes me feel like, am I even human in your eyes when you say, what are you? And when I say that I'm an Indigenous person, it's hard for some people to understand what that even means. And that continued struggle that I face my entire life is something my children also face, and it makes me really sad. And I appreciate you sharing stories about your kids. I have a teenage son, and I get very nervous about him going out at night by himself, wearing his hoodie in the rain and in the dark. We live in Corvallis, but a lot of what I've heard really resonates with me, and it's pretty much same experiences up there. But I'm always telling him, you need to be aware, son. You know, like I really encourage my children to be proud of who they are as Indigenous children and people and pass on our ways, but we live with some pretty ugly realities that have to do with violence, and it's tough to live with, and it's tough to talk to kids about in a way that they can understand and still not live in fear. And so that's one of the other pieces when I think of language and the legacy of Dr. King is that concept of like being proud of who you are and being brave and being bold and being compassionate for each other, because those pieces can create a lot of change if we put some intentionality behind it. Some other things I think about when I think about his legacy and his use of language, he was such a powerful speaker, and he also was a very big supporter of Indigenous rights and movements. He worked closely with some Indigenous activists of his time period, and that gets overlooked a lot of the time. And I think it's important to acknowledge that solidarity work was happening and acknowledge that he wasn't saying that everybody necessarily had to like get along in a certain way, but I think that's a legacy that gets passed on, but it was more to live with each other and understand our truth is how I interpret what he was saying, because we all have that truth that we carry with each other. And yeah, that was pretty much what I wanted to talk to you all about. Yes.
Thank you all. We'll now take 5 minutes and have table discussion and come back with questions. Thank you.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Welcome back to our program, Keeping Dr. King's Dream Alive, Decoding Language. Before we get to questions, we would like to thank our gold sponsors, Banner Bank, Jerry Detelm, architect and landscape architect, Pacific Cascade Credit Union, Luvas Cobb, and our in-kind sponsors, KVRM, Radio, Dot Dotson Photography, Pack Info, and also to KLCC for airing our programs on Monday at 6:30. Thank you for Community Television of Lane County, Channel 29, for posting these on television. We'd also like to thank the Springfield Public House for hosting this week's session of Oh, the Places You Will Go, a course for teachers who want to learn more about local economy and the work it offers. City Club partners with Eugene and Springfield Chambers, the Lane Workforce Partnership, Lane Education Service District. Because of the excellent speeches, we have very little time for questions, but we'll start with Mary.
Hi, I'm Mary Layton, representing sponsors, Network Charter School since 2006. When we think and talk about oppression, we focus often on injustice and suffering. But another consequence is less access to new forms of beauty. I'm thinking of the dying languages of some of the indigenous people. But in particular, music. The university has an event coming up to share something beautiful. Can you tell us, Dr. Alice Asenso, what is happening next week and why?
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. So next week, sorry, thank you. Stand up. Okay, I will do that. My mother would love you, by the way. So that's what she always told me. So quickly, University of Oregon and Oregon State University have come together with Lane Community College and others to host the Higher Heights Deeper Love Concert. It's a gospel concert, and there's nothing like gospel music to celebrate both sacrifice and celebration in song. So we are bringing in four groups, three of them nationally acclaimed, one internationally acclaimed, the University of Oregon Gospel Choir. And for being here today, you get the gift of a free ticket.
Cool.
To the concert.
One for you, one for you. One.
And Marty is distributing those in the back. So we ask that you not only come, but that you bring your neighbors and your friends, Oregonians from all walks of life, to be inspired and share hope with one another for 2019. Thanks so much.
Believe me, you do not have to be religious. You do not have to be Christian to enjoy gospel music. I've been to the concerts. They're great. Jerry?
Thank you. Jerry Smith. This coming Sunday at 3:00, First Christian Church is going to dedicate a huge mural of Martin Luther King. And I think of him as a Christian saint of this century. There's nobody that matches in my mind. What he's set up and is being reestablished is the Poor People's Campaign. And many people have identified, because of Martin Luther King, that poor people are black. Do you know the numbers of people who are poor? My guess, it's about 100 million white people in the United States that are in poverty. Something like 70% of all the poor.
Thank you. Who wishes to answer that?
What we know is that because the United States is populated primarily by Caucasians, that the white folks are among the poor, the most poor. But what you find is that people of color are disproportionately
among the poor. And what happens is that people then use disproportionality as a way to tell the story of poverty without really actually allowing folks to know that the folks who are most poor in this country are white. So that's what I know based on that. And if you look up the book, Farayah Shadei, do you guys remember the title of that book?
I don't remember.
Don't Believe the Hype. I think it was, and it goes through about 20 myths about race and racism in America. It's by a Harvard practitioner, published about 10 years ago.
Can I add something about that?
Yes, go ahead.
One of the other reasons why using numbers can be a little bit tricky too is, do you need me to?
Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. One of the other ways that can be problematic or tricky to use numbers too is because if you think about indigenous people, a lot of times not everybody's counted in data, and also a question that I get asked a lot when I'm doing work with other folk is, well, that's not gonna change that much, and I'm like, that's because of a thing called genocide. There's hardly any Native people left compared to what there used to be, so if we're only like 1-2% of the general population, the percentage is already not even gonna be counted in the data because it's so low. And you see that in statistics with Native people all the time. Start taking a look at any data that goes out and then Native people aren't even on it. And so if we're talking about languages of erasure, that's another way that that happens, is through statistical data that's reported out and that people use and rely on. So I appreciate you bringing up the proportionality piece. Thank you.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we're out of time. For those of you who wish to continue to celebrate the life of Dr. King, there are a couple events. There will be the annual NAACP March, led by our own incoming president, Eric Richardson, on Monday, January 21st, 2019, 9 a.m. starting at Autzen Stadium and ending at the program after the march at the Shed. And on January 25th, the Division of Equity and Inclusion of the UO will host an evening of gospel music at Matthew Knight Arena. Also, next week is a big week for City Club. Two major events. We will host Governor Brown on Tuesday at 1 p.m. at the Ford Alumni Center, 1720 East 17th Street, parking below the building right next to Matt Knight Arena, beginning at 1 p.m. No lunch will be served. Parking is available at the garage. On Friday, we have former Governor John Kitzhaber joining us here at 12 o'clock on Friday, rebuilding community, moving beyond new tribalism. At the Baker Center, lunch will be served as usual. And on Wednesday night, Eric is going to cross-examine me at Tsunami Books as part of the Community Spotlight program. My understanding is he's been watching old reruns of Perry Mason in order to get ready. More details about and information about future programs can be found on our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now, if you'll join me in thanking our speakers, Greg Evans, Joe Lowndes, Dr. Yvette Alex Asensio, and Lou Whitebear, for a great program. Thank you very much, folks.